Every single moment I've learned has something to offer, something exciting and beautiful. I take that new awareness out into the world and use it for all the times that I have. To learn and to understand that every moment of life offers you something beautiful, something to see.
If you're victimized, it's because you're telling yourself that the world ought to be different than it is. That's what most prayer is for a lot of people. It's a neurotic kind of prayer. It's the prayer that says, "Dear God, please make the world different than it is. Please, that the world is the way I want it to be, rather than the way you created it." And it isn't that way. People in themselves, I think, are afraid to be God. We're afraid to be God. We're afraid to have God within us. We're afraid to be our own creator of what we want for ourselves. Instead, we want it to be something outside of us. We want someone else to do it for us, like God, or like Mother, with the way she used to be, or whatever it will be. And until you're willing to be God, that is, within you, allow yourself to be that moral, effective human being who is doing the things that are going to make life better for you and everybody else. Until you're willing to do that yourself, all it is hoping that somebody else will do it. And that's much of what is considered contemporary organized religion is a very neurotic notion that God is going to do it for us instead of the belief that we're going to do it for ourselves. The place at the top, which is way, way up there at the ceiling, is what I call mastery, where you are to your own life like a great painter is to his or her creation, molding it and shaping it, reacting, having self-creation, being into the person that you want to be, and being able to react and handle every situation that comes along, and understanding that happiness is not something that you strive for, that you go after, that it is something that is always within you, and you can have it anytime, anything that you're doing. Not very many people get a hold of that. They think there are happy things to do and unhappy things to do. Happiness is available for you anytime you want it, whether you're cleaning out your closet, whether you're sitting on the can, whether you're changing your baby's diaper, whether you're working on a project that is exciting for you, whether you're going on a camping trip, whatever it is that you're doing, that happiness is something that's available to you. Normal people don't speak the kind of language, and I'm talking transcendent kind of language, that when you're around these kind of people, they inspire you, even if they're not even trying to convince you of anything. They have an aura almost about them that you know you're around a special human being. It's like their presence motivates because they transcend the typical. They transcend the normal and go into areas that no one ever dreamt of before and don't even think about the consequences of whether it's going to work or not work. That isn't even an issue for them. A man of knowledge, Carlos Castaneda wrote about in A Separate Reality. He said a man of knowledge lives by acting, not by thinking about acting, and not by wishing that he had done something that he hadn't. He said a man of knowledge understands that what we're doing in life really doesn't matter, but he acts as if it does, so that when his acts are over, he retreats in peace. And whether they worked or didn't, whether it was good or bad, is right or wrong, is in no part any part of his concern. It's like understanding that if you're going to get things done in life, you've got to be able to transcend all of the reasons why it can't be done. Okay. Again, the question, what are the specifics? And I am determined that I'm going to lay these on you because I've been thinking about them a lot in my life, helping people to manage their own emotions, teaching people to not be victims, and to the point of getting where there are no limits to your thinking, possibility thinking, whatever you want to call it. And we've looked at people in the world who seem to be operating at this level over and over and over again. And what are they like? What are these qualities of these human beings? Basically, and you can look at yourself as I go through some of these. Basically, at the top, I think probably the thing that stands out, and I'm not just talking about philosophers and professional people and people who have achieved a great deal of success. It has very little to do with that. It has to do with people who seem to go through their lives neurosis-free. They see life as a miracle, something to enjoy, rather than something to carp about and to find fault with. That no matter what the problems that come along in their lives, these people somehow seem to be problem solvers. They seem to be able to get out of the way of all of the stuff that boggles down so many of us. They just almost bypass it. They let it go past them. I have with me a very, very, very special person I would like to introduce to all of you. Let me just tell you a little bit about this lady. She had made a decision that she was going to start her own career in an executive position as an insurance executive down in Florida and took off with her family and made the decision based on something that she really had believed in and had been one of those people that I'm trying to describe to you now, one of those people who knew how to manage her own emotions, who knew how to be in charge of herself, maybe just a little bit at a higher level than most of the people around her. No courses, no yoga, no conversations with the guru, none of those things. Just somebody who took things as they came along and handled them. This is the kind of lady that I'm talking about. Someone who was looking for solutions with three small children of her own. May 23rd, 1980, rolls around. Sharon is on her way home, driving in Florida, 11:30, 12 o'clock at night. And somebody's following her. She's kind of aware of it, but is used to the fact that in South Florida, men are on the make, kind of, and pays no attention, and doesn't look over and want to attract any attention. They're driving down a road, about 45, 50 miles an hour, and a man pulls up alongside of her, takes out a gun, and shoots her. The bullet goes in her left eye, severs her optic nerve, blinds her instantly, and exits out her right eye. She has no sight then, now, and everyone else says never. But she didn't believe that. So she's blinded, and she pulls the car over at 50 miles an hour onto the side of the road and stops, begins to lay on the horn, begins to think about instantly. She knew she was shot, and she knew she was blinded and bleeding profusely. A man pulls up, puts his hand inside the window and says, "Who could have done such a thing? Let me help you and take you to a hospital." Well, it was the man who had shot her. And instead of taking her to a hospital, he took her to an apartment where he proceeded to participate in a night of terror too vile to describe. Raping, stabbing, left for dead, 8 hours of terror. She managed, after he assumed, I think, we all think, that he assumed that she was dead, as she learned through the night how to handle him. When it came time to be firm, she knew how to do that, just to survive. Because survival was what was at the core. She had three children and herself to live for, and wasn't going to allow herself to die. And used that capacity that I'm trying to cultivate in everyone, and why I brought Sharon up from Florida to be on the show. She went into the hospital. She was in intensive care for almost 3 days. Hours and hours and hours of surgery. They gave her new plastic eyes. And 5 days, 6 days, 7 days later, she was home. Taking her children and dressing them, without any therapy, without any depression, without any lingering hate, without the things that most people who are victims of violent crime say to themselves, that it has to be this terrible thing. And she's now on a campaign to try to end some violent crime across the country and to teach women how to use what she so magnificently displays. When you look up the word saint in my dictionary, you'll see a picture of Sharon Marie Komloff. Those kinds of qualities that I'm talking about not only help us to daily run our lives in an effective way, but they set us up as survivors. when the research was done on the survivors at Auschwitz, at Buchenwald, at all of the horrible death camps all over Europe during World War II, and they looked at the survivors, there were certain qualities that these people possessed that so few people have. The ability to not judge the world, but to accept it for the way it is. The ability to say, these are the conditions of my life now. When somebody tries to use guilt on them, instead of them buying it, they just kind of pass and it goes past them and they're too busy being involved in their lives to be thinking guilt, to be thinking worry, to be concerned about what everybody thinks about me, to call people up and say, these are my problems and let me tell you all the things that are wrong with me and let me tell you about my diseases and let me tell you about my colds and my backaches. And they don't spend their lives on that negative side. They're consumed almost with living and enjoying, and most importantly, with making the world a better place for everybody. See, in our culture, we have a thing that in place of quality, we have size for neurotic people. We forget about the quality of life, and instead we become consumed with how big is it? How much did it cost? How does everybody else view it? Whether it's our car, whether it's our home, whether it's our enjoyment, whatever, we want to know, we want to put a price tag on it. And in Western civilization, particularly in the United States, there's a heavy emphasis on appearance rather than quality. And as a result of that, in the daily running of our lives, we substitute also the quality of life for the trappings of success. For somehow believing that if I work real hard and get way ahead, then things are going to be better. If I do get that car in the garage, if I get that home, those are the things that are going to bring happiness and fulfillment, contentment into my life. And they never do. They never, ever do. You get it? And how do you account for a Judy Garland or a Marilyn Monroe or a Freddie Prinze or somebody who has everything? Committing suicide or becoming drug addicts, or how many affluent people, the people who you think really have it, that's what you'd really like to have, don't know how to handle it, don't even know how to deal with their own trappings of success, because they believe, rather than in quality, they believe in what I just call size. And in place of ethics, so many people have rules, just rules. You see, an ethical person doesn't need any rules. None at all. When you think about quality and ethics going hand in hand, the important thing to keep in mind is that rules are things that people impose on everybody else so that we can get everybody else doing everything the way they're supposed to. Now, there's nothing wrong with laws and certain number of rules. We have to have them in order to make our culture work. We certainly need red lights, stop streets. We certainly need laws against larceny and things like that. But if you need somebody else to tell you that you can't do something and always are imposing rules on yourself, while it isn't going to necessarily make your life unhappy, you are still guided by things outside of yourself. And highly functioning people somehow have ethics wherein they can break rules that everybody else thinks are sacred, and yet there are other rules that they have within themselves that nobody else would even think of. Their rules, that is, are ethical. Their ethics come from within. And they're based upon how you treat yourself and how you treat humanity.
Secret of the universe. It's never too late to have a happy childhood. Never. You don't like your childhood? Fix it. I didn't get to go to any amusement parks. It's open. It's open, but I'm 68 years old. You want to go to the amusement parks and want to be three too? Get your head out of Uranus. You know, you're 68, you missed out on amusement parks, get over there. They're open, they let you in. You can do anything you want. If you don't like something about yourself, are you shy? Are you nervous? Are you a lousy cook? Are you not coordinated? I've heard a lot of people tell me that. I'm just not coordinated. It's what I call the C syndrome. They'll take a basketball, they'll go out, they never played in their life, they'll go out, they'll go like this.
They'll miss.
See?
I told you, I could never play this game, and that's it, for the rest of their life. They don't do that.
Forgetting something so crucial, failure is wonderful.
You are looking at the king of failure. Right here.
Yeah, I failed a lot in my life. Still do, all the time. Babe Ruth struck out more than anybody in the history of baseball the year he hit 60 home runs. You want to hit home runs? You better be willing to strike out.
A lot.
You better be willing to fall down. A lot. But what do you do when you fall down? Do you say, see, I told you I was a failure? Or do you get up and say, well, that didn't work. Don't do that.
I'm always reminded of Thomas Edison, who was working on inventing a storage battery, some way to store electricity. He knew kind of what it was and so on, but he just didn't know how to store it in any way. And he had tried 25,000 different combinations. He still didn't have a storage battery. And one of the reporters asked him, he was like 77 years old, and they said to him, Mr. Edison, how does it feel, someone as famous as you, to have failed 25,000 times? It must be awful. He said, failed? I don't even know what you're talking about, failure. He said, today, I know 25,000 ways not to make a battery. What do you know? Failure is only bad when you equate it with your self-worth. When you say, because I fail at something, that makes me a failure as a person. The healthiest place you can get to is the place where you're willing to try anything. Healthy people will try virtually anything. And they're not afraid. They don't live by their customs. They don't live by their traditions and the rules and everybody else's dictates. No, not at all. Someone who isn't afraid to fail because they know something very important. When I walked in here today, my self-worth was intact. It comes from myself. That's why it's called self-worth. Now, if you like me, that's nice. And if you applaud, and if you laugh, and if you enjoy, that's terrific. That's better than if you don't. Yeah, I like it a lot better. I love approval. I think it's the most wonderful thing in the world. The difference is, I don't need it. If I need it, that means when I don't get it, I collapse. That's what a need is, isn't it? One of those secrets of the universe that Icus will lay on you, the understanding that first, foremost, get this clear, all right? You are not what you do. If you are what you do, then when you don't, you aren't. Isn't that true? You are not what you do. Your value doesn't come from what you accomplish. Your worth as a human being does not come from your successes out there. Your value doesn't determine by whether or not you win or not. Don't you understand? If you have to win in order to have value, then somebody else has to lose. And that somebody else who's losing is determining whether you're a winner or not. And if they don't cooperate, then you're a loser. When you always are looking over your shoulder to determine whether you're valuable or not, you're giving your value up as a person and putting it in the hands of somebody else who you hope won't hit the ball over the net or who won't be able to run faster than you or won't make as much money as you. Don't you understand that those people are now controlling your life? And if they hit the ball over the tennis net one time more than you do, that makes you a loser? And it's in their hands? No, you're not what you do. You are what you believe about yourself. Your value doesn't come from anything but what you choose to think. And your corner of freedom in life is the willingness and the ability to think anything you want. That's yours. No one can change that for you. No one can take that away from you. You can think what you want. Your corner of freedom is that you can think in the way that you choose. One of the most important things to learn in life is a sense of appreciation for yourself. Here's what success is and how it comes to you. And it's the easiest secret of all of Icus's messages to us. If one advances confidently in the direction of his own dreams and endeavors to live the life which he has imagined, he will meet with a success unexpected in common hours. Yeah,
You get out there and lead your life fulfilled, happy, excited. Success will chase you in the numbers that you need it. And it'll always amaze you. And the more you reach out and help others and give away what you have, it'll come back to you in even larger numbers.
Be a human being who consults inner signals on how their life is going to be run. And this has nothing to do with abusing anybody else or wishing other people ill will or stepping on anybody else or anything like that. You see, to understand the concept of inner peace, of being an inner-directed person, you have to understand that you are unique in all the universe. In all of time, if there was a beginning to our universe, if there is an end to it, which we don't even know, we can't even begin to understand it, it's so huge and incomprehensible to us, no one can ever get to an understanding of themselves, of the universe, of what it means to be a fully functioning person, unless they get to this point called inner peace, which we can't get a hold of. Now, your uniqueness, your specialness, you sit in this room right now, thinking whatever you're thinking. And people ask me, Wayne, aren't you concerned about your reputation? Aren't you concerned about what those people think about you? And I say, there are 2,000 people here today. Now, I have 2,000 reputations going right now. It's true. I have no control over what each one of you decides you're going to do with what I say. My reputation is not in my hands. I have no control over that. In The Sky's the Limit, I talk about the word dichotomy, which is just a term that means two opposite points of view, male, female. A dichotomy. Right, wrong is a dichotomy. Good, evil is a dichotomy. Black and white. We have people who tend to think this way all the time. And no limit thinking means fusing dichotomies, getting rid of this business that men do one thing and women do other things, and then so we've got male, female, and black, white, that black people do this and white people do that, or that right itself and wrong exist independent of each other. To get past that, there's another dichotomy. And a very important one for you to understand, which is that you are at one time special and unique, which is one extreme, and at the other extreme, you are also a part of the entire universe, of all of us. That is, if we are all related in some ways to each other, and if one of us is starving on this planet, then a part of all of us is starving, and yet you are still unique and special in the world. And to be able to fuse that dichotomy, to be able to say to yourself, I am at once male and female. I am at once capable of doing anything a woman can do. So therefore, I don't have to be concerned about whether I'm doing something that's feminine or masculine. I can be gentle. I can cry and not be suspicious. In my position of rightness about what I believe, there's also room for hearing what somebody else has to say and even being willing to change that. And in my position of being special and unique, there's also lots of room for me to be a part of mankind, of all of mankind. Getting that into you, understanding that as you sit here right now, no one has ever thought what you're thinking. No one has ever occupied the space that you occupy. I mean, really understanding what philosophers call the existential aloneness, that you are alone in the universe. And that your aloneness, you must experience that in a way that you never allow yourself to be down by that or depressed by it. So you can take something like aloneness and say, you know, I really am alone in the world. Nobody can ever get behind your eyeballs and feel what you feel, and experience what you experience. Nobody can ever do that. Only you can do that. You can be in a room this size and still be alone, and you can be making love to the person you love more than anything in the world, and you're still alone. They're still experiencing that in your own unique and special way. And the closest you can get to somebody else is to their surfaces. If this is true, all right, if you understand your aloneness in the world, you begin to take responsibility for yourself. You have to ask yourself then, the next question is, if that's true, why are there so many neurotics? How come there's so many crazy people in the world? Now, just a few statistics. One out of every 18 people in this room is an alcoholic and in need of treatment. Drinks, needs alcohol every day in some amount in order to get through their day, and has it every day. There are some that are more severe, but between one out of every 17 and 18 people in our entire culture need something outside of themselves in order to get through their day, called alcohol. Just alcohol. For the year 1979, the last year for which the statistics are available, there were 100 million prescriptions for Valium and Librium in our culture. 100 million prescriptions, 20 pills in a prescription. There's only 220 million or so of us in the United States. And we had 100 million prescriptions for something that doesn't even exist. Yeah. You see, people take Valium to get rid of anxiety. And there is no anxiety in the world. The world is perfect. The world is just the way it is. I mean, this is not a bad day today. This is just the day you get. You get a lot of them like this, but they're still perfect because it's the only day you get. There's no anxiety out there about this day, except in the people who say, this is the 19th straight day we haven't had sunshine. Or if it's in the winter, they invent things to be upset about. The temperature, it isn't cold enough. You know, just temperatures aren't enough. Let's have wind chill factor so we can make it colder so we can be more upset. It's only 38 below out there now, but you add that wind chill factor, we're talking 76 below. And if that's not enough, then what you do is you keep track of how many consecutive days it's been there. We're good at that. The slogan out there, today is the first day of the rest of your life. No, it don't work that way. Mm-mm. No, we got to change that today. That's a dumb slogan. Okay? Today is the last day of your life. Now, there's a slogan. And I'll tell you why. Because you don't have any rest of your life guaranteed to you at all. Okay? None. No. Mm-mm. What you get is now. And you've got to learn that death is really kind of, you know, Woody Allen said it's nature's way of telling you to slow down. It'll do that. But, like, you got to get that in perspective, okay? Life itself, this is one of Icus' secrets. Life itself is an unfinishedness. Life is an unfinishedness. It's not like you're going to get it all organized right into the right place and then check out. No. Mm-mm. God tells you in the morning, you'll be checking out tonight about 11:30. About the time Johnny Carson comes on, you'll be leaving, joining me tonight. You say, wait a minute, God, you don't understand. I bought 3 bottles of shampoo. And for me, God, we're talking 10 years before I use that up, right? Right? I got the 22-ounce bottles. I only use a tenth of an ounce each time I do it. As soon as I use up that shampoo, and God, by the way, I got a whole lot of steaks in the freezer. Haven't even been touched yet. Got them on sale. God said, be about 11:20, you ain't going to see the sports tonight. Now you're making me mad. You don't want to make God mad on your last day, uh-uh. He could take you now. So, you now know that this is your last day. And you also know that you're going to have a half-empty tube of toothpaste when you check out, okay? So get used to that, all right? Don't try to get everything in order. It's never going to be ready. Anyway, so here's what you do. You get it in every day, you begin to tell yourself, this is the last day I got. Because you know something? All of us here, sometime or another, we got to face a last day. There's nobody leaving here alive. No, there's a real good saying that they have on Uranus.
The last suit you wear, you don't need any pockets.
You have to have one hanging in your closet with no pockets in it to remind you. No, I ain't wearing this one. I'll save this for later. Don't have to take a wallet. Don't need any credit cards. Look, the best you can do, the best, this is all I can give you. You can die owing master charge 3 months, okay? You can do that. But you get a little bonus, but you ain't getting much more. Now, when you say that to yourself, when you tell yourself, this is the last day of my life, you get a whole new perspective on life. Now you're in a traffic jam on your way to work, and you know this is your last traffic jam, the last one you get. You're going to enjoy the hell out. You stop, you get stuck at that bridge. There were guys going crazy over there. You thought that they had just delayed their whole life. Bridge was up 3 minutes. If this is your last bridge crossing, you'd be checking that bridge out real careful. You introduce yourself to everybody in line there. Excuse me, this is my last day. My name is Wayne Dyer. I'll be leaving tonight. But I want to tell you how much I like that bridge there. Boy, that's nice. Yeah. No rush. Take it easy. Take your time. Yeah. One of the statements that I've made over and over again over the years is that we get treated in life the way you teach people to treat you. And I think there's a lot of truth in that. That certainly doesn't excuse or put the blame on you if you're being abused by somebody. It doesn't excuse the abuser. But on the other hand, you have to always look at what have you allowed to transpire. Why have you created a situation in your life where you've allowed this kind of thing to continue? The whole thing about getting treated the way you want to be treated really starts with your own image of yourself, your own view of how you believe you deserve to be treated. And if you believe that you deserve to be treated in a certain way, you simply don't have any tolerance within you for being treated the opposite way. But even more than that, it's like, what are your expectations for how you'll be treated, and how do you see the world? Before I started seeing the world as a harmonious, beautiful place filled with brotherhood, now, there are a lot of you listening who say, yes, but what about all of the examples of the absence of brotherhood and the horrible way that people treat each other in our world? I would suggest that you really take a look at the facts and understand that for every act of hatred and aggression or racism or negativity in some way, that there's a million acts of love and harmony and goodness towards each other, and that there's a network of good guys in the world, and a very, very small number of really abusive people in comparison to the number of people who are doing terrific and wonderful things. The problem is that the horrible things that people do to each other make the news and get our attention, and we talk about all the time, whereas we just sort of take for granted whenever a hurricane happens that everybody bands together and just everybody helps each other out. When any crisis arises, when we need to raise money for something that happens in the community or whatever, as a people, we find the will and the way to make it happen through love and through caring and through decency. So I tend to view the world that way and believe that it's silly that we allow a very small percentage of people's crass behavior to dictate how we live and think. Even the whole problem with drugs and so on in the streets, to me it seems silly that we've allowed the streets to be taken over by 1% of the people when 99% of the people want to live together in harmony. And once we realize the strength that we have in those numbers, that we'll see those shifts taking place. In fact, I think we are seeing them take place. So one of the ways to get people to treat you the way you want to be treated, I think, is to view people as good and decent and caring and important. And then to understand that your experience of everybody in your life is really nothing more than your thoughts about them. I mean, you can't be somebody else. You can't get behind somebody else's eyeballs and be another human being. So the only way you have to experience them is through your thoughts, through your process. So your experience of your coworkers and your husband and your children and everybody that you come into in your life is all done in your mind.
That's where your experience of them takes place.
And if in your mind, which is your corner of freedom, to have and to think any way that you want to, if in that mind of yours, you tend to view people as good rather than as evil, you tend to see the positiveness in life rather than being focused on the minority, the tiny, tiny percentage of negativity that's in the world, you're going to almost create that with your expectation. At least that's been my experience. I have taught people how I want to be treated basically through a very simple thing called the Golden Rule, you know, which goes way back. And it's not the Golden Rule that applies so often in the capitalist world, which is he who has the gold makes the rule. It's the opposite. You treat people in life the way you want to be treated. I have found that with my children and in my family situation, I find that that more and more we have a much more loving bond between us because of this sort of Golden Rule philosophy that that I'm espousing here. And part of this Golden Rule philosophy is knowing, taking responsibility yourself for how you're choosing to process things that you might previously have processed in a way that would cause you to be angry and upset and hurt and so on. You can very often see somebody striking out at someone verbally, and you can defuse that really fast by simply saying something like, "Boy, you're really having a tough day today. I see that you're really frustrated. There's so many things going wrong. Boy, it must be really tough to try to manage so many different people." And it's like all of a sudden one caring person has entered this person's life who everybody else thinks of as this abusive or nasty or whatever person. And all of a sudden that person is like, "How can I help you? You know, what can I do?" You know, giving them something, whatever. It's like taking responsibility yourself for turning it around, you know? And the more that you're able to do that and to approach situations in your life that way, it seems to me that the less likely that you're going to be somebody else's victim. See, the same thing applies to positions of authority when people are trying to manipulate and control you through their position in life or through their authority or whoever they are. Let's say you're going before the IRS and they have the authority on their side. They are the big guys, and you are the little guy, and they've got the wheels of government, and they've got all the threats, and they, you know, and they can throw you in jail or whatever. And yet, I've been through many IRS audits, and everything that I'm saying here absolutely applies there. I have never come out of an IRS audit without the auditor, and the accountant, and all the people involved in it feeling very good towards me. You can't be intimidated if you don't choose intimidation as a response. And if you also get past the need to be right or to make somebody else wrong, if you're beyond that, in other words, if somebody is talking down at you and saying something really abusive towards you and you feel that you're being treated in a way that you don't like, you have so many options available to you at a moment like that. One of them options is to get angry and to get into a confrontation and tell them off and to show them that they're not going to do that, and you'll probably end up with handcuffs on and, you know, being taken. There's another possibility. It's like to understand the reality of the situation that you're in, that this has nothing to do with you. This isn't who I am. I am not a speeder. That isn't my role in life. I mean, I know who I am, and I'm very comfortable with that, and I'm very at peace with that, and I believe that I'm a good person and a decent person, and it's like that belief, that self-image of who I am as a person, I take into every confrontation or every interaction, rather, that I have with everybody. And if that's intact, then that person's behavior is just his obnoxiousness coming out. It doesn't have anything to do with me. It's his stuff. He owns it all. And so I don't buy into any of it. Instead of responding with, you have no right to talk to me like that, I will respond with making it clear that this isn't my stuff. In other words, if you're talking, you know, real abusive at me, my response would be, "Wow, you're really having a tough day." You know, I was just maybe going over the speed limit, and you know, but you see, I don't expect that when I get pulled over, when I'm in a position of authority, when I'm applying for my driver's license, or when I'm in a bank, or when I'm dealing with, you know, somebody at the
at a government office or an IRS thing or a police officer or whatever, I don't go into it making it a contest. It's never a contest. I'm not in a contest in life. I'm not in competition with anyone. I'm absolutely at peace and comfortable with who I am as a human being. And I bring that to those encounters. And when you bring that to those encounters, you get people who mellow out real fast and who are really decent to you. I can't tell you how many times I've been upgraded to first class on an airplane just because I've been nice to somebody, because I've done something where I've seen a situation that could become very volatile, and I diffuse it with just an act of caring, with an act of decency. And boom, I've got somebody who was an extremely abusive person very much on my side. This past summer, a man said some things to my daughter and a couple of her little friends, and they're only 7 years old. And he said some, from what they said, some very nasty things. I went down to see who this person was, a great big bruiser of a guy with couple of tattoos on, a real stereotype of what you would expect. And I just started talking to him, and it turns out this guy was really a very gentle, really nice, terrific person. We became friends. We played tennis together over the summer and so on. And the kids had, he had lost his temper in a split second because they were splashing and actually doing some things that they were in a place that they didn't even belong. And he apologized. He said, yeah. He said, I raised my voice. He said, I just lost my temper for a second. But he said, I didn't mean it. He said, I got kids of my own, I know. And it was like, instead of going down there with fire in my eyes and creating an enemy, I go into a situation like that looking for a friend and thinking that everybody that's out there has this potential. And this doesn't mean that you go through life being wishy-washy and being abused and so on. What you're doing is you're avoiding the abuse. Most of the abuse and the victimization and the stuff that haunts so many people in their lives comes from their need to be right and to make the other person wrong. Years and years ago, I was a teacher at a school in Detroit, Pershing High School. This was now 1965, 66. I was 26 or 27 years old. And I was just a substitute teacher in the building, what they call a resource teacher. And I was working in the same building every day. They had 128 teachers in the building. So there would always be one or two absent, and I was like a permanent sub. And the theory was that you would get to know the student body and so on by being in the same school. Only one day I'd be teaching math, the next day I'd be in the gym, the next day I'd be a counselor, the next day I would be teaching home ec, and whatever. And this is what I did in that school. I did it for a couple of years while I worked on my master's degree. And it was an integrated school. And if you remember back in those days, this was in Detroit, and they were having riots back in 1967. In fact, my daughter, Tracy, was born during those riots. And a lot of the students had walked out of, a lot of the black students had walked out of quite a few of the schools, particularly in the very inner city. This was sort of a semi-inner city school. I'd say it was about 30% white and 70% black. Well, the black students at the school at Pershing were talking about walking out. They were going to have a demonstration, and they were going to have this, and they were going to, and they were going to get very violent and so on. And the principal was going to have to deal with this situation. Now, it was going on all over the city. And in some of the schools, particularly at the in the very inner city, I think it was Northwestern and Central High School and so on, they had some pretty violent activities taking place, and the students were walking out, and there was threats and going on and so on. But Pershing had always been a school that had prided itself on its harmony, its racial harmony in the community and so on. And it was an integrated community, and it was really a wonderful place to work. It was one of my greatest joys was being at that school during those years. The principal knew enough not to go in there and talk to all of the students because he was the authority figure in the school, the principal. And the principal's going to go in and make demands and so on. He asked me, a young kid, really, who was just a substitute teacher in the school, if I would talk to the students. And I asked him why. I said, why would you want me to go into the auditorium and talk with the students? And he said, because you have a calmness and you have the respect of all of the people in the school. And this was as a young man. I'm not saying this bragging or to toot my own horn. When I walked into that auditorium and talked with the students, with the president of the student body, whose name was Joe Briscoe, who was a young black kid there and an athlete and a very fine young man, and we stood up on that stage and we talked to them, it became very calm in there. in the face of something that could have turned into something really ugly and really... It's like Pershing became one of the schools that worked at solidarity, at building a sense of caring and harmony. And it was all done through not making anybody else wrong. As we talked and the students aired their grievances and talked and so on, it was like nobody was wrong, nobody was right, nobody was in positions of authority. You can do that any place in your life you want to. If you've got that inner calmness and that serenity about yourself, you can take virtually any situation and turn it into something that you want it to become. And you can do that in your home, you can do that in your family, you can do that in your business. And it always depends on how do I feel about myself, what do I think I deserve, and how can I radiate outward what it is that I have inside. And if what I have inside is harmony and peace and love and divineness, if I have that inside, then that's what I'll have to give away. If I have anger and hostility and hatred inside, then that's exactly what I'll have to give away, and that's how I'll get treated. Freedom is a word that we throw around in our culture a lot, I guess, because we live in a place where freedom is sort of taken for granted. But there's another kind of freedom other than just the freedom to express yourself and the freedom to vote and things like that. And that's the freedom that comes from knowing how to really enjoy your own life and all that your life is. And this is a freedom that can never be taken away from you, even in the worst of circumstances, even by putting you into a jail cell. You can't take that away. It's the knowing, that's a key word. It's the knowing of having control over your own mind. Knowing that. It isn't just that you read it or you listen to me say it or whatever, but that you develop this powerful awareness that I truly am in charge of all that I am as a human being. And like once you get that knowingness, that it isn't circumstances and that it isn't the terrible things in life or the things that we've judged to be terrible that make our lives what they are or what they are not, it is how we process them. It is thinking that makes it so, as Shakespeare said. Then freedom is yours. It's yours to use at any time that you want to use it. Happiness and enjoyment are not things that you get out of life. They're not rewards that come to you. They're not something that is going to be the result of you behaving in a certain way or living a certain lifestyle. Happiness and enjoyment are inner processes, and they are what you bring to life. They are yours, and yours alone, to have at any time that you want to have them. And no matter what the circumstance that you can think of, no matter how bad it may seem for you, you always have this corner of freedom to choose to process it the way that you want to. And so happiness or fulfillment or enjoyment or whatever, if you get nothing else, get this really clear for yourself, that they have nothing to do with the circumstances of your life. It's not relevant. It's not even an issue that you ought to be bringing up. Over and over you'll hear, yeah, it's easy for you to say that you can be happy because, and then they'll list all the reasons why somebody else can, and then they come up with, these are all the reasons why I can't be happy. And this list will be very, very long indeed. Never ever once saying, well, the reason that I am not happy is because I don't bring happiness to what I'm doing. It's because I'm looking for happiness as some external thing that is going to come to me. It's like what Ica says, there is no way to happiness. Happiness is the way. And happiness is the way is something that some people have all of their lives. It's something that I have had as long as I can remember, and it's the thing that I can remember my mother tells me about when I was an infant, before I was, when I was just like 2 years old, before we were moved away for a while, and when we came back, and throughout all of my teen years and so on, that I was always someone who knew how to make other people laugh and how to enjoy life and would always look at the bright side of things rather than the negative side. It's just, and I think back to what I was talking about earlier about purpose and discovering that purpose. And once you discover that purpose for yourself, in the process of meditating and going within, I have discovered what my real purpose was, is a peaceful purpose. If you believe in the concept of eternity, then you believe in it for yourself. And if you believe in a concept of eternity, then you believe there's, you don't believe in beginnings and you don't believe in ends. You believe somewhere, in some dimension, somehow, there's an infiniteness to all of this. And if that's the case, then you look at your own life as like a parenthesis in eternity. There's an open parenthesis, which is called your conception, and then there's a closed parenthesis called your death. And in there is your life. And then before that parenthesis, there's this void that you know existed. I mean, you read history books and you know that there was something there. And then on the other side of the closed parentheses, there's like what goes on at the end of your death. You ask yourself the question, what am I here for and what is my purpose and how can I be happy in the fulfillment of that purpose as I live my life, which is what I want to do. I want to feel joyful, I want to feel good as I live my life. Who doesn't? That's what we all want. And I want to feel successful and I want to feel happy. So then you say, all right, I'm going to, first of all, I'm going to find my purpose. I'm going to find out, what am I here for? What am I about? So how do you do that? I'll just share with you how I did it. I went through in my mind, in meditative experiences, and re-experienced earlier phases of my life. I could see myself at the age of 30. I could see myself in my mind. I could see the clothes I was wearing. I could see the relationships that I was in. I could see the home that I lived in. I could see the room. I could see what I was working on in my life. And I could see myself. I could see my face, this 30-year-old face and this body, what it looked like at 30. And I thought that was really interesting to see that in the world of thought, nothing dies. So that in thought, which is where we experience our life, 30, for me, which is 20 years ago, still exists in my mind, right? Because memory, all memory is just thought, formless. And then I could experience 20. And I could literally pick a day in my 20th year, which was 1960, and be in that day. I could literally, I had enough information. It's so amazing that they find that as people are dying and they call them senile, you know, that they say they just blurt out dates and events and things on a Tuesday, April the 3rd, and it was 1891. And then you go look it up and you find that it was real. I mean, it's like, so that everything that you experience in your life is there somewhere in this computer called your mind. And if you work hard on it enough in your meditation, you can be there and you can get to the day, January 12th, you know, 1960. You can get it and experience that day and who you were with. It. And you could do that for literally every day of your life if you could train yourself well enough, if you thought it was worthwhile. So anyway, you can go back and you can be 20 and you see yourself as this 20-year-old kid and you look at the path you're on. And you look at what you're doing. And then I can go back in my meditation to being 10. And I can see the 10-year-old boy, and that 10-year-old boy is there. Everything about that little 10-year-old kid is there. The quarterback on the local football team and all of the things that I was doing at the age of 10. And it's interesting, as you look from the perspective, as you go back through these stages of your life, in your meditation, and it becomes very, very real, you can see that what you're doing, you become that in your mind. You sort of meld the present with the past in your mind. And you can see then what you were doing at that time and how it led to, and you can see almost like this phenomenal plan that was taking place. All right? So you're discovering your purpose, but you're going backwards to do it. Okay? And then you can go back right to your birth. And in some places they call this like a rebirthing kind of thing. There's nothing airy-fairy about it. There's nothing weird about it. It doesn't require any special crystals or any incense or anything like that. It's not loaded with any of the paraphernalia that becomes associated with it. You literally, in your mind, you're getting so good now at going back in your mind that you can experience your own birth. And you can even go back to before your birth. You can guide yourself right through to your conception, right through to and look at the time. And I look at the time that, and if you believe now, we'll go back to what I was saying a few minutes ago about this parenthesis in eternity, that there was a moment in which you existed in form and a moment before in which you didn't. I mean, that's just logical, and that it has to be. What was the moment before you existed like, and the moment that you suddenly existed, and why? Why did you come into form? If you believe in a perfect universe, in a spiritual place that we are all in, and that on all of this enlightenment principles that I'm talking about here, then you know in your heart that you showed up here for a reason. Okay, so now it's like I'm doing this in a few minutes, whereas we're talking about over a period of months that I went through this thing in my life, where into my mind I kept going back and going back and discovering that I had a role in all of this. If there was a moment in which my conception and a moment before that, and if I had any voice in that as a formless being, then coming in now at this time has nothing to do with any accident. It has to do with part of God's plan, whatever, which I am a part of. And so here I am on purpose now. And if my purpose is about peace and about loving and giving and sharing, if that's what I'm here for, and my whole life as this has unfolded, I've had a lot of lessons to learn about not doing that in some relationships and then getting out of that relationship and then doing it in the next one, and it's like the whole business of not failing but producing results and so on, so that I've gotten to the point now where I can see this whole panorama of a life from beginning sometime in 1939 and up until now. And I ask myself the question always now, am I on purpose or am I on outcome? Okay. And there's a big, big difference between the two. Being on outcome is always about unhappiness and lack of fulfillment and lack of success. It's always about where am I going? What's in it for me? What am I going to get out of it? What are my rewards going to be? How much am I going to make? How am I going to do? How are other people going to see me? It's about outcome. It's about winning the match rather than being in it. It's about trying and not arriving, striving and not arriving. It's about all kinds of stuff which keeps me out of the moment and into some future moment, which I can't live now, and always about some kind of how it is for me. But then I remember my purpose. And my purpose has nothing to do with outcome. So I try to get my life back on purpose. Now, if whoever you are, if you can get your life on purpose, that is, I believe in my soul, I mean, that the deepest part of me believes that you cannot fulfill yourself other than through service to others, that you are not here to get, you are here to give. It's the only thing you can do is give. You can't get anything. You can't hold on to it. You can't keep it. You can't take anything with you. The only thing you do in your parentheses in eternity is to give. You can give away what you are. And so as I stay on purpose, I'm always happy. And if you know that your purpose is to love and to give and to serve and to share and to be in harmony and peace, and that's what I think it's about, that's what I think the human story is about, then as long as you are there, you can assess virtually everything you're doing in that context. Am I on purpose? Am I on purpose? And when you're not on purpose, when you're off of purpose, you will find your blood pressure going up, you will find yourself frustrated, you'll find yourself anguished, you'll find yourself in pain. But when you're on purpose, time will have no meaning. It doesn't. There is no time. Everything is glorious. Everything is fulfilled. It's like being in a beautiful dream. It's like being in a garden. And everything is just absolutely magnificent and not waking up from that. So, like, get your life on purpose, and you'll find that happiness won't be a question you'll ever, ever ask yourself about again. You can assess virtually all of your unhappiness in terms of your inability to stay on purpose. There are many ways to get along the spiritual path. There are many techniques, many things that you can do. I don't think my outlining them is going to make you do them, even though I will be glad to do it. What will do it for you is that satori, it's that awakening, that once you go through the gate, once you see yourself with these signs of transformation and moving in this new direction, you'll see your quest for inner peace move from being a quest to being a reality, and you'll find yourself doing some of the following things. You'll find yourself meditating more all the time, not having to go into some deep meditative kind of experience where you have to be alone and you have to have no noise and you have to have all distractions removed and you have to have music playing or anything like that. You'll find yourself in 3 or 4 seconds being able to go into, wherever you are, being able to go into a peaceful meditative state and have God right there with you. You'll find yourself able to do that once you believe that God is there for you. Once you know that, that your guide and your multi-sensoriness that is beyond just your 5 senses, that there's a world beyond that. Once you believe that and know that, you'll be able to go there. And you will consult it often. And I would recommend that you do. Do it in the middle of a meeting. Excuse yourself and just go to the bathroom. And just go find a place that you can sit down for a few minutes and watch your breathing and close your eyes. Regroup yourself and get yourself very, very peaceful. Sometimes people will call me on the telephone right in the middle of when I'm doing this at my office. I'll just stop in the middle of whatever it is that I'm doing and they'll call and say, "Wow, what were you doing? Were you sleeping?" I said, "No, I wasn't sleeping. I was just meditating." And I'll be very, very... There's no stress in your voice at all. You know, you can go there at any time. It's like learning to be quietly in a room alone, learning to allow yourself the serenity of doing that. You can also, with the people that you love, just have quiet time together. Instead of having a television on, you can just hold each other for, even if it's only for 5 minutes' time. Just put your arms around the person that you love and just hold them and tell them that you love them and that you're glad that they're in your life. It's a powerful little thing to do with your children. You can just hold their hand for a few minutes and squeeze them real hard and tell them how great they are, or go for a little walk with them, or go look at a flower with them. Those are the kinds of little tiny things. They may not sound like much, but all of those kinds of actions which are in the direction of giving rather than receiving are indications of your spiritual advancement and you're coming in contact with that beautiful, endless universe within you, the universe of love and harmony.